The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled The Culture of Arabs, The Renaissance of Greek Philosophy and Science, is dedicated to the merit and honor of Rav Shlomo ben Harav Moshe with Devorah Bas Rav Moshe Aaron, Dr. and Mrs. Solomon and Louisa Nussbaum, on the occasion of their 50th wedding anniversary. Western civilization rests on three pillars. The name of each pillar begins with the letter R. The first pillar, or R, is revelation. The divine revelation to Abraham, Avraham Avinu, Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, and the subsequent prophets form the basis of not only Judaism, but also Christianity and Islam. It also forms the basis of how Western man has traditionally viewed his place in the universe and the ultimate purpose of life. The whole notion of revelation is there are important truths that God has revealed to mankind. The revelation of Abraham and Moses, which is common to all the three major Western religions, states that there is but one God who created and designed this world. It's a world that reflects the unity and intelligence of its creator. This revelation also contains the message that the creator of the universe is not distant, but actually interested and accessible to all of mankind. The God of Abraham and Moses is not merely an it, a distant philosophical concept, but a you. When Jews pray, they refer to God in the second person. Baruch Ato Hashem, blessed art thou, blessed are you, God. And he, in turn, responds to our prayers, as we say in davening every day, three times a day, Korov Hashem Lachol Korov. God is close to all that call out to him. According to this view, man has a very special place and purpose. The whole world was made for man. According to the Talmud and Sanhedrin in 37a and Lamed Zayin Amud Aleph, everyone is required to say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam. Because of me, the world was created. But man is not merely a passive witness to God's presence on earth. Man has a mandate to take a very active role in this world. Milu es ha'oretz v'kivshua. Just fill the world and conquer it. And not only is man required to wrought physical change, but moral and social change as well. Like Avraham Avinu, says Abraham the patriarch, man is required to become like God and to act with justice and kindness. This revealed view of reality, God and morality reign supreme over the world. Man is full partner with God in morally perfecting himself and the world about him. All three Western religions believe that eventually there will be a judgment day when every man will have to give an accounting before God how he has fulfilled this moral responsibility. The R for revelation, hence, is the first pillar of Western civilization. By the way, according to Jewish tradition, the revelation of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, not only contained within it the moral truths and legal system of the Torah, but also the entire body of wisdom that today we call science and philosophy. You see in your handout, on the first page, the Talmud states in Rosh Hashanah, this is in Chof Aleph Amud Beis in 21b, 50 gates of understanding were created in this world. All were given to Moses, save one. As it says, and it brings this is the Tachsireu Ma'at Melokim, that man is slightly lower than God. He's privy to all the secrets of the creation. The Ramban, Nachmanides, suggests that that which is missing, that last of the 50, is the understanding of God himself that only God fully understands. But Less than that, man, at least in the visage of Moses, was privy to all. We continue on in the second citation here, paragraph B, that because Moses had this revelation, and it was contained in the revelation of the Torah, as it says in the Medrash here, is in Mishira Shirim Rabbah on the first Parsha, that there's an allusion that it was revealed to Moses that all the secrets, the secrets of creation. It's because of that prophets at a later day were able again to reveal great mysteries of the physical and spiritual universe, and you could read the citation, because it was part and parcel of the original revelation to Moses. Inherent in this Medrash, it's saying that all the subsequent prophets only saw what Moses saw. If Moses didn't see it, the other prophets weren't able to see it either. He's the Av Kol HaNaviim. He is the father of all prophecy. In Moses' prophecy lies all further prophecy. And therefore the prophets who were able to have a great insight through prophecy of the physical and spiritual universe only were able to because it was part of the prophecy of Moses. So Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy contained not only what we call Torah, but really the secrets of the universe itself. There is a question, though, did Moses himself pass it on? As perhaps this was a vision he saw, that he was given 49 gates of wisdom, but not necessarily did he give it to his disciples. But we have a quote from Maimonides, from the Rambam, and this is the bottom of page 1. And he speaks again about the relationship between science and philosophy and revelation. And he says, and it's worthwhile to quote because it's a classic. And this is taken from the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed, in the first book. This is in chapter 71. You should know that the true understanding that our nation had regarding these areas in science, philosophy, and metaphysics, outside of direct halacha or spiritual knowledge, was lost through the course of time and persecution. This was due to the fact the knowledge of these areas was not handed down to the masses as was scripture. But evidently the Rambam maintains there were individuals that Moses did reveal these secrets to. You're already well aware that even the oral law was not originally written down. And this was part of the oral tradition. This area of knowledge was handed down orally from Sinai by a select few exceptional individuals to a select few. This is the reason why this knowledge was ultimately lost. So according to Maimonides, this knowledge was part of Moses' revelation, and it was something that he passed down. You know, it's interesting as well, there was a book that's alluded to in the Talmud called Sefer HaRefuas, the Book of Medicine, that was that it seems had all the secrets of medical knowledge. Chizkio HaNovi, the prophet, says, hid it, put it away. Says, and missing that we have to resort to other means. Rashi explains the reason that he hid it was if one always had a cure for one's ailments, one would never resort to prayer. Why should you pray? You know, just go to the druggist. So becoming cured is not so easy, and therefore there's the room for Hashem. This is Rashi's explanation. But again, the idea of a Sefer Refuas is that there was really, it seems, it's part of the original body of knowledge. The Torah was a complete body of knowledge. And this is something in the Ramban, Nachmanides makes this point in his preface to his commentary on the Torah. He maintains also that all of this knowledge, not only was it orally handed down or revealed, but it's hinted at in the Torah. In other words, it's encoded in the Torah. We hear about the codes of the Torah with the Dilogoisius, with the letters which have a certain distance one from the other, and there's certain messages. The Ramban doesn't allude to this system, but does say that they are all of its knowledge was encoded into the Sefer Torah. This Ramban does say Nachmanides. One of the great scholars of the 11th, 12th century in Spain was Yehuda Halevi. And Yehuda Halevi wrote in his classic Kuzari, claims that this knowledge even predated Moses. It comes before Moshe Rabbeinu. And if you look on page 2, you can look at yourself. He claims it originally came from Adam HaRishon. The first man was a prophet. And there was a body of knowledge was handed down before the Torah. And again, eventually it was not continued on amongst the Jews, but it found its way to the Greeks, at least in some form, in a roundabout manner. Because the Greeks came in contact with these nations who originally came in contact with the Jews, they were privy to this knowledge. He claims also that the knowledge was not something which was created by the Greeks, but was borrowed by the Greeks. And he notes that after the Greeks were conquered by the Romans, they had not produced a philosopher of note. On paragraph E, we quote from Josephus in his work Against Apion. And he shows from writings of other Greeks that Pythagoras, one of the great ancient mathematicians and Greek philosophers, not only knew Jews, but many of his doctrines were as a result of his contact with Jews. And as you could read through this on your own, but the last paragraph, the last sentence reads, "For it is very truly affirmed in this Pythagoras that he took a great many of the laws of the Jews into his own philosophy." And we have, finally here on paragraph F, we have the Theophrastus, who was a disciple and a successor of Aristotle's, spoke of Jews in the highest terms. Evidently, they were very impressed with the level of philosophy that the Jews had. According to Yehuda Halevi, and according to the Rambam, this knowledge was part of the original revealed knowledge. So here we have science as part of revelation, which again now leads to the next R. First was revelation, which we spoke about, the revelation, the legal and moral revelation. And there is the scientific revelation. But the next R, the next pillar of Western civilization is reason. And again, as we've pointed out, that according to Jewish tradition, science and philosophy originated with revelation. Either it's the revelation of Moses, the Moshe Rabbeinu, according to the Medrash and the Rambam, or the revelation of Adam HaRishon, of Adam, according to Yehuda Halevi. The science and philosophy that have formed the basis of Western civilization have come down to us, says, from the Greeks, not through revelation, but through reason. This is how it's presented to us. No matter how they originally got it, but their presentation to us is, this is a product of reason. The mathematics of Euclid and Archimedes, the science of Aristotle, the medicine of Hippocrates and Galen, the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, are all presented by the Greeks as products of human reason. According to the Greeks, the human mind on its own is capable of grasping many, if not all, the truths of life. And it's here the traditional Jewish view and the Greek view part company. Even though reason and logic are the fundamental tool of the Talmud, reason in the Talmud is only a handmaiden for revelation. It is only used as means of developing and rediscovering the truths of the Torah. It is never used on its own. Whereas according to the Greeks, reason alone without revelation is a reliable means of discovering the truth. The secular humanists who deny revelation and rely exclusively on reason find their inspiration from this Greek pillar of our civilization. This pillar, the second pillar, reason, is closely related to the third and final R of Western civilization, the pillar of recreation. With this, I'm not referring to recreation, but recreation. It's referring to the prestige and pleasure derived from recreating the human form and the human experience. Sculpture that truly imitates life has its roots in Greece. The exquisite sculptures are created by the Greek sculptors, Phidias and Praxiteles, as we find them in museums and the Acropolis in Athens, were copied and served as an inspiration for sculptors of the human form for thousands of years. In the words of the Roman writer Virgil, quote, "The Greeks shaped bronze statues so real they seem to breathe, and carve cold marble until it almost comes to life," end quote. Drama was yet another art form whose Greek roots have a profound influence to this day. To recreate human feelings, the pathos and joy of life, the way we react to stress and tension, as well as to good fortune and humor, is an art as fresh as Broadway and Hollywood and as old as Athens. The institution of a theater with actors, props, a stage, a musical accompaniment are all Greek creations. Even the novel, the portrayal of human life in prose form, has its roots in Greece. History, as an academic discipline, also has its roots in Greece, not in Israel. The history that's recorded in Tanakh, in the Hebrew Bible, was written from a divine perspective, an extension of the Torah. It's God's guide for living. The lessons of history contained in the Bible are basically centered around the theme of how mankind in general, and the Jewish people in particular, have either lived up or failed to live up to God's mandate, and how God in turn has reacted towards them. In contrast, the histories of Herodotus and Thucydides and those that came after them are written from a human perspective. Man's story and not God's is the major focus. The R of recreation of the human experience is the third pillar of Western civilization. These last two Greek pillars of civilization, reason and recreation, or science and art, have much in common. First of all, both science and art share a dimension of beauty and a sense of the aesthetic. The same sense of aesthetic that produced the sculptures of Phidias and Praxiteles also produced the plays of Aeschylus and Sophocles. The same aesthetic sense that produced the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle also produced the mathematics of Euclid and Archimedes, and the medicine of Hippocrates and Galen. For a scientist or philosopher, beauty is not limited to the recreation of the real world, but extends to discovering the beauty and logic that already exists in the world. It's no mere coincidence the Greeks, who according to the Talmud were the embodiment of beauty, which we will soon see, were also founders of modern science. Yet there's yet another common feature of these two pillars. Art, drama, and history can all be classified under the heading of the humanities. They represent a love of humanity, not in the Jewish sense of concern and brotherly love, but rather in the sense of a lover of pizza or fried chicken. An artist is a lover and a connoisseur of humanity. Hence the satisfaction of reproducing, recreating the human experience. Similarly, reason or science, in the form that it came down to us from Athens, not Sinai, represents the faith in humanity to discover the truth. No need for the intervention of God. Man and man alone can take care of himself. This reliance on human reason is closely linked with humanism, the belief in human potential, and of course is closely linked with the love of humanity. As you can see, there's an inherent tension between the two Greek pillars of humanism and the Jewish pillar of revelation. To the Greeks, the highest compliment was being called a philosopher, a philosoph. Philo is a lover, and soph is wisdom, a great, independent, creative thinker. Even though the Jews produced and continue to produce giants of intellect, to them the greatest compliment was to be a lover or servant of Hashem, of God. According to the Jews, God spoke to man and gave him the Torah, a guide for a spiritual and moral life. To the Greeks, God gave man intelligence, an intuitive sense of beauty and logic. Through that intelligence and intuition, man can find all the answers and reach his perfection. In this light, we can well understand the struggle of the Maccabees against the Greeks. Judaism and all that it stands for represented a threat to the Greeks. The Maccabee struggle, which we discussed in the previous lecture, was the struggle of humanism versus revelation. But through the last 2,000 years, humanism and revelation have been able to find some accommodation. It would seem that the Torah is alluding to this accommodation and the blessing that God bestowed to Shem and Yefes, the sons of Noah. And again, this already takes us to page 3 in our notes. Here it's from a Gemara in Megillah in Tesomet Beis in 9b, where it finds a scriptural allusion to the fact that Greek language is allowed to be an alternate language of the Torah. And it's finding an allusion that the Septuagint, or at least the original Septuagint, the original translation of the Torah in Greek, was something which was part of the divine plan. And here in the first paragraph on page 3, we find the reference to it is there's a blessing to Yefes. Yaft Elohim Yefes, which in a simple meaning that he should expand, v'yishkon ba'olei shem, and he will dwell in Shem's tent. The drosha is that Yefes Yaft implies beauty. Yofi. Yafusa shall Yefes, the chief beauty of Yefes, is destined to be in the tents of Shem, in the Semitic tents amongst the Jews. And here the allusion of the Greek language, the beauty of Yavan, in Jewish tents. It would seem, though, history has proven that more than the language and the script has come down to the Jews. Really, it's the whole beauty. When Herod built the temple, the last revision of the temple in Yerushalayim, it was really built with Greek lines. We can see today the vestiges of that, with Greek columns and Greek capitals, Corinthian capitals. But not only the Jews are descendants of Shem. And this is something we've pointed out before. According to Jewish tradition, the Romans are also descendants of the Semites. They are descended from Esav. And here we have on paragraph B, which Rashi quotes. This is the Torah in Parshas Vayishlach. This is chapter 36, verse 43. It's referring to the leaders of Edom, the dukes of Edom. One of them is Magdiel. Magdiel is a family that settled eventually, refers to that section which has Roman connections. There's another, it seems from other commentators, that amongst the various migrations of populations through the century, there are those of Esav, of Edom, who went and populated Italy. Hence, the blessing of Greece in the tents of Shem could be understood, partially to be understood, of the Greek contribution to Rome, which Rome, in a sense, is the basis of today's civilization. And we end off this section here paragraph C with the Medrash Rabbah. This is in Parsha Tezayin. Explains the three things the kingdom of Greece preceded the evil kingdom, referring to Rome, through its laws and etiquette, its writings, and its language. The Romans borrowed from the Greeks. So it's really through the, as we're going to see, that the Greeks, the beauty of Greece came to other descendants as well. But the first one that it really found a resting place was Rome, which again, according to Jewish tradition, it comes from our descendants of Esau, the brother of Jacob of Yaakov. Over time, the Romans as well as the Greeks adopted another culture and value system as well, a Jewish one, was Christianity, a religion based on revelation. In the process, though, of trying to meld humanism and revelation, the church so embraced the love of humanity that the Christian God himself came in the form of a man. The human now became divine. The Greek love of recreation was now being channeled in the service of the church. Greek sculpture and art were now being used to create images of Yeshu, Mary, and the saints of the church. And Greek columns, Roman arches, and domes were put to use to create magnificent and awe-inspiring churches. But the early church was suspicious of the areas of Greek culture that represented independent reason and the glorification of man, like separate from God. Over 1,000 years passed until Christendom began to embrace in earnest the other aspects of Greek learning and culture, which we call today's Western civilization. The scholastics from the 12th and 13th centuries integrated Greek science and philosophy with Christian revelation, St. Thomas Aquinas. The humanists from the 14th century reintroduced Greek and Roman art and other areas of humanities to the Christian world. The whole Renaissance, in the late 1400s, 1500s, again, are a result of the melding of truly pagan Greek art into the church. The inherent tension between that learning and culture, with the original revelation of Abraham and Moses, forms much of the history of European man from the Middle Ages to the present. Part of the Reformation was a reaction to this paganism of the church. But in the early Middle Ages, when much of the learning of the Greeks was unknown in Western Europe, because again, the church really took the art of Greece, and not the philosophy and science of Greece in the early years, another descendant of Shem, Yishmael, the son of Avraham, was successfully able to keep and expand upon the original contributions of the Greeks while remaining loyal to the notion of revelation. And again, we're just trying again to repeat this idea that there are three pillars of Western civilization. Those pillars in Western civilization today, the pillar of revelation is represented in Christendom by the Old and New Testament, the church. It's represented in Islam by the Quran. But the blessing of Yafusa shel Yefes and Ole Shem, this blessing that the beauty of Yefes should be found in the tents of Shem, was fulfilled in amongst the church in bits and pieces. But to the Arabs, the descendants of Yishmael, it came sooner, and it was due to their preservation that much of the learning of the Greeks found their way to Western Europe. And it's a fascinating story. The whole notion that the sons of the desert, I mean, these people were Vildachayas, I mean, the pre-Islamic Arabs, which we went over in a previous lecture, should become bearers of culture is one of the oddities of history. The first 130 or so years from the death of Muhammad, from 632 to the founding of the city of Baghdad in 766, saw a flowering of Islamic and Arab culture, not Greek culture. This was purely Arab and Islamic culture. Because of the need to supply the linguistic needs of the newly converted Muslims, the scientific study of the Arabic language and grammar began. A rich religious body of Arab literature also began taking shape. The Quran was written down, commentaries were composed, and the oral traditions of Muhammad and his companions were inscribed. A secular poetic body of literature also developed, expressing ancient Arabic themes of love, wine, and hunting. When you learn Gomorrah, you don't see much of this, but for the Arab, this was really part and parcel of their culture. But also, again, speaking again, the Afusish El Yefis, the beauty of Yefis, the beauty of the Greeks, an Arabic architecture began in this period as well, borrowing and adopting Byzantine motifs. From the first lecture of this series, the Byzantine Empire was the Eastern Roman Empire, and the language there was Greek. And the Arabs borrowed the dome, the arch, and the mosaics. But they were able to create a distinctive style that's admired to this day. It was in this early period that the Mosque of Omar on the Temple Mount was built. All through this period, though, the Arabs still basically retained their distinctive culture. So their architecture became a distinctively Arabic, was taking the Greek and modifying it, but the culture was by and large very Arabic. But with the founding of Baghdad, a new chapter in their history began. Because of Baghdad's proximity to Persia and India, and because it developed into a world cosmopolitan center, the Arabs began importing ideas and concepts very different from their origins. In the year 773, an Indian traveler introduced into Baghdad an Indian treatise on astronomy. It's called the Siddhanta, which was translated into Arabic by order of the caliph. That treatise became the basis of the astronomical tables of the famous 9th century Arab astronomer and mathematician Al-Khwarizmi, of whom we're going to speak of later. From that time on, the Arabs began to take a real interest in astronomy. Under the direction of the Caliph Al-Maimun, who reigned in the beginning of the 9th century, astronomical observatories were built in Baghdad and outside Damascus. The Arabs knew even then that the world was round, and under the direction of the Caliph, astronomers performed an impressive measurement of the Earth's circumference. Their measurements yielded 56 and two-thirds Arabic miles as the length of a degree of the meridian, exceeding the actual length by only 2,877 feet. As an Arabic mile is approximately 1 1/4 English miles, and the real length of the meridian at the equator is 69.17 miles. But through their observatory, we're speaking about something which is, turned is like about half a mile. So something where the Earth's circumference is some 25,000 miles in circumference, being off a half a mile is nicht gefährlich, you know. If my wife would give them an A, probably. That same Indian traveler also brought with him a treatise on mathematics. It was through that work that the numerals that we today call Arabic were introduced into the Muslim world. The man most responsible for popularizing these numerals was the aforementioned Al-Khwarizmi. The term algorithm, the forerunner of the modern term algorithm, which originally referred to Arabic numerals, is actually a variant of his name, Al-Khwarizmi. Take the E, Khwarizm. Al-Khwarizm is algorithm. He was the founder, through him, of the numerical system. This Al-Khwarizmi composed the oldest extant work on arithmetic and the oldest work on algebra. Until the 16th century, in Latin translation, it was the principal mathematical textbook used in European universities. through a translation of his work, the Indian invention of the number zero, the cipher, and the decimal point for place values eventually made their way into Western Europe. Without zero and the decimal point, modern mathematics would be impossible. It was through Al-Khwarizmi that the Arabic words algebra and cipher entered our vocabulary. Cipher is from the like Sphirus Omer. This pair is counting. So this is what a cipher is. It's a place. It's a zero place. It gives you your tens, hundreds. That was through them. Another Arabic word that came into our vocabulary is alchemy, or chemistry. One of the fathers of the science of alchemy was Jabir ibn Hayyan. Acting on the assumption that it was theoretically possible to convert base metals like tin, lead, iron, or copper into gold or silver, he spent his life on this fruitless search. In the process, though, he carefully recorded his experiments and gave the Western world a wealth of knowledge in the field of chemistry. The Latin translations of his works became standard chemistry texts in the Western European universities in the Middle Ages. You probably never thought of Arabs like this, but during this time, they were on the cutting edge of mathematics, astronomy, science. But probably the greatest Arabic contribution to Western civilization was their preservation and translation of the Greek works on philosophy and science. In the 100 years between 750 and 850, the works of Aristotle, Plato, Claudius Ptolemy, Euclid, Hippocrates, Galen, and many others were translated from the Greek to the Arabic and studied with great interest throughout the Arab world. From the 12th century and on, these translations were in turn translated into Latin for the use of Western scholars. By the 12th century, the original Greek manuscripts from which the translations were taken were for the most part no longer in existence. Had these Arabic translations not been made and preserved, these works would have been forever lost to humanity. But the Arabs were not merely translators. In virtually every field, they made significant contributions. In the field of medicine, their contributions are many. It was they who established the first pharmacy shops, founded the first school of pharmacy, and produced the first pharmacopoeia. Already in the early 9th century, in order to be certified, druggists had to pass an examination. In the 10th century, after a case of malpractice, a caliph ordered all the physicians of Baghdad to undergo testing for certification. Over 860 doctors passed the examination. All others were prohibited from practicing medicine. There were as many as 34 hospitals in the Muslim world during this period. Probably the most noteworthy Muslim physicians in this period were Al-Razi, Erasus, and Avicenna. Al-Razi, who lived from 865 to 925, was one of the keenest original thinkers, and one who based his medical findings not only through the works of Galen and Hippocrates, but actually through his own experimentation. And this he wrote down. His best-known monograph was a treatise on smallpox and measles. His best-known work was called Al-Hawi, which was an encyclopedia of medical knowledge that summed up the medical contributions of the Greeks, Persians, and Indians together with his own insights. In Latin translation was printed when printing was in its infancy in 1486 and went through many editions. By the way, an interesting story is told about Razis. He was about to build a hospital, and he wanted to build it on the most sanitary site in all of Baghdad. So he decided to hang out shreds of meat in different places throughout the city. He figured that the area of the city would produce the least health problems would also have the least effect on the meat. The spot where the meat significantly showed the least putrefaction was where his hospital was built. After Razis, Islam's most prestigious physician was Avicenna. He lived some 200 years after Rhazes, from 980 to 1037. His major work, called in Latin the Canon, was reprinted by the end of the 15th century some 15 times. Already, printing was in its infancy, in Latin and once in Hebrew, I guess for the Jewish doctors. From the 12th to the 17th century, this work served as the chief guide of medical science in the West. As we're going to touch upon, Avicenna was one of the fathers of Arabic philosophy as well. In this age of scientific renaissance, be interesting to note what, if any, was the Jewish contribution to the sciences. Like the Arabs, the Jews had no interest in the humanistic aspects of the Greeks, many of which are severely censored in the Talmud, in terms of their literature, in terms of their theater. However, as we stated in the beginning of the lecture, wisdom, including scientific wisdom, was considered part of the original revelation to Moses. The Talmud speaks at great length both about astronomy and medicine. Both are spoken of in a very positive light. See on page 4 of your handout. There's a fascinating passage in the Talmud. It's taken from the Gemara in Shabbos, Ayin Hei Amud Aleph in 75a. He who knows how to calculate the cycles and planetary courses, but does not, says, of him Scripture says he has no regard for the work of the Lord, nor does he have any regard to the operation of his hands. It seems to be understood, and this is how Maimonides understood this, that a greater understanding of science leads to a greater religious experience. Of course, it assumes that one comes with the premise, as the Rambam states, that there is a designer. And if one assumes that this world did not come about by itself, but was designed, the more one looks, one is amazed by that design. If one, of course, doesn't have that viewpoint, one spends his whole life trying to reason and rationalize how everything could have come about just by itself. But if one assumes that there is a designer, the more one sees, the more religious one becomes. The Gemara also states, and this has to do with part of the tradition, this is part of really the Torah, of calculating the cycles and planetary courses, that this is wisdom that the non-Jews understand as well. And therefore it's a requirement, it's part of the Torah itself. At least under that part of astronomy which deals with interfaces with halacha. Shmuel, the great authority of the Talmud, was also a great astronomer. And on page 4 we have on paragraph B, Shmuel said, "I'm familiar with the paths of heaven as with the streets of Nahar Dor." Nahar Dor was his hometown. And again, you could look at the other references to his great knowledge of astronomy, but it was not. His knowledge outside of Torah was not confined just to astronomy. He was a master physician. And again, his pronouncements about medicine are quoted widely in the Talmud. And again, you can see the quote that I have on the bottom of page 4. What's interesting to note, though, is despite his profound knowledge of both astronomy and medicine, on page 5, we find the surprising statement of Shmuel, that Shmuel interpreted the statement on the level of Drash, where the Torah says, "Loi b'shamayim," this Torah is not in heavens. He understands it to mean on the level of drasha, that the Torah is not found amongst astrologers or astronomers whose professions deals with the stars. In other words, if you're going to dedicate your life to a life of science, your ability to to study Torah is by that measure diminished. I mean, a person only has X amount of minutes that they will have to his life. And if you're going to spend it outside of Torah, even though it's fine and it's wonderful and one gets a greater understanding of the world and God's creation, but that's that much time that's spent not understanding Torah. And Shmuel understood that that really one's time should be spent, if one can, in Torah itself. So they challenged Shmuel. But you're an astronomer. I mean, how did you get, evidently, how could you expound the thesis that one should not spend extra time, in other words, in the study of science, but rather in the study of Torah, and you yourself are a scientist. I only study science when I can't study Torah. And we see that even though it's held in a very high regard, science, but yet it seems its role is really inferior to that of the study of Torah. But I would like to quote here, but these are quotes we know from science as recorded in the Talmud. But what about the period under discussion, the period of the Gaonim, the period of the flowering of Arabic science? And here we quote from an Arabic writer. This is a Spanish writer from the 11th century. And he wrote a book. This fellow says Abu al-Qasim Sayyid ibn Ahmad ibn Abd al-Rahman. You won't find the telephone directory. But he wrote this book, which is widely quoted. He wrote this book, which is the Categories of the Nations. And he went through all the different peoples of his time and described them. And he has a section about the Jews. And here we have, as for the eighth nation, they are the children of Israel. This is on page 5. And they have not become famous in the sciences of philosophy. However, their concern is with the sciences of religious law, Sharia, which is, and the biographies of the prophets. In other words, basically, you think for the most part, Jewish minds in the Middle Ages were involved in the study of Torah. Their scholars are the most learned of men in the knowledge of the prophets in the beginning of creation. It is from them, the scholars of the Muslims, and he quotes three scholars, which seem to be all apostate Jews. Jews who went over to Islam and who wrote in great length about the early traditions and of Yishmael. And this is Abin Ali ibn Abbas. This is Ka'b al-Akhbar. These are quoted widely in Arabic sources as sources for early tradition. These were all basically apostate Jews, and they got their knowledge from Jews. But there was among them in the Empire of Islam of those who became famous in the art of medicine. And he quotes this Masajual, the physician who was entrusted by Umar ibn Abd al-Aziz. This Umar, by the way, was in a previous lecture, we discussed the one who created the anti-Jewish legislation, the covenant of Umar, but his personal physician was a Jew. And he was told to, this is the translation of a, of Aaron al-Akas, I guess another Jew, to translate it. He himself, this Major Jouais, is not only is a, well, only is a translator, but he was an author himself of two books on medicine. And it continues on about a person that we that the Jewish world knows of. This is Yitzchak ben Shlomo HaYisraeli, who was a Rosh Yeshiva, who was one of the, who would be considered probably the closest thing to the Rambam, to Maimonides, in early medieval times. He lived almost 100 years. He was an outstanding physician, and he served the says Abd Allah al-Mahdi was a founder of in North Africa. He was the founder of a dynasty of caliphs that were Shiites and not Sunni Muslims. And he was the personal physician. Evidently, it seems that he originally lived in Egypt and he moved to Tunis to practice medicine. He moreover possessed knowledge in logic and he was an expert in varieties of science. Amazingly, he never took a wife, which is very odd, and he did not acquire property. He authored excellent books, among them a book on foods and a book on fever, which has no equal, a book on urine, a book on elements, and a book of definitions and prescription, a book known as A Garden of Wisdom, the questions of metaphysics, physics, which seems evidently to have been a work which preceded the famous book of Munavideus of Rav Sadia Gaon. We know from sources that Rav Sadia Gaon did correspond with him, but very little of his original writings are known. But we do know that Ibn Ezra, in the 12th century, refers to him as one of the Chachomim of the yeshivas of the Arabian kingdom. He wrote a commentary to the Torah. Very little has been preserved from him, but he was this multifaceted person, much like Rav Sadia and the Rambam, except we know that he also gave, as similar to the Rambam, medical contributions to the non-Jewish world. And he continues on, says, any names, a person otherwise we wouldn't know, a person, Sal ibn Bashir Habib, who was an astrologist. So I'd like to summarize what we've gone through so far. We went through originally the idea of the three pillars of Western civilization. There's revelation, there's reason, and there's recreation. And if we look outside today in the world that we live in today, those streams, the streams of Christian and moral thought, which is part of Western civilization, again, which is based on Jewish sources, we live of the revelation of Avraham Avinu, the revelation of Mount Sinai. We have the sense of science, the belief in mankind, that man, through his reason, can solve all his problems. And we find the tremendous stress given to recreating the human experience in the human form. The whole movie industry and theater are all part of this third pillar. That third pillar really emerged in Western civilization much later, in this last millennium. But the pillar of reason and science appeared first in the Arabic world and then on to the Christian world. And Jews, it seems, at least in a small part, were part of that process. As we stated before, it was the Arabic preservation of Greek science and their own contributions that made it possible for Western Europe after the Dark Ages to continue the scientific tradition. But there's another area of Greek thought that had an immense impact not only on the Arabic and Christian world, but on the Jewish world as well. This was the area of philosophy. In universities throughout the Arabic world, the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle, as well as the subsequent Greek philosophers, were studied and debated. The questions that were raised touched the very essence of religion and belief, and the relationship of reason and revelation. Great Arabic philosophers of the Gonic era, such as Al-Kindi, Al-Farabi, and Avicenna, struggled with the same issues that prompted the Rambam in a later era to write the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. There's the issues, was the world created, or has it always been here? This is a very weighty issue, which the various Arab philosophers had different views, because the Greek philosophy was, the world always existed. Do we have free will, or is everything determined? And again, there were various schools amongst the Arabs.
the Rambam states very clearly that the basis of Judaism is based on the idea that we have free will, and not everything is predetermined. By the way, the idea of predeterminism versus free will is also touched upon by Josephus, who quotes that the Essenes believed in predetermination, and the Pharisees, which is the forerunners of Chazal, of the authors of the Talmud, is believed in free will. Their writings had a tremendous influence on the church in the 12th and 13th centuries and formed the basis for the Christian response to Greek philosophy. The Jewish world in the Gaonic era, in the early Middle Ages, also created literature in response to Greek philosophy. We just mentioned a few moments the works of Rav Yitzchok Yisraeli, the one who was quoted by the Spanish author, who lived for 100 years, which is no longer extant. One of the most renowned works of the Gaonic period was the Emunah V'Deis, the belief and knowledge written by Rav Sadia Gaon. Is to this day one of the great classics of Jewish philosophy. The time doesn't allow, we have to really give a whole lecture to philosophy. What are the issues? How are they dealt with? How are they dealt with to this day? We plan, Mirtz Hashem, to spend a subsequent lecture in the coming year devoted to philosophy and what the Arabic and Jewish response was to these very basic questions. But let me summarize. Western civilization owes a great debt to the Arab world. We tend, again, to think of Arabs since, like, we look at the Arabs today. But as we quoted in this lecture, the Arabs were very much part of this preservation of science and philosophy. And Jews seem to have made a significant contribution as well. But throughout this, though, the Jews primarily looked at themselves first and foremost as a people that were mandated to preserve and understand the revealed knowledge of the Torah and the Talmud. In other words, the R of revelation was primary. The other R of reason was important but secondary. The model of the Gaonim and their predecessors to Torah and Mada, general knowledge, set the general tone and attitude to such knowledge throughout the subsequent Jewish history. Rav Yitzchok Yisraeli and the Rambam were rarities. They were great Jewish doctors, of course. But those who were great in both were Rosh Yeshivas, and at the same time were people of such intelligence to give a lasting contribution to the corpus of human knowledge were very few. And by and large, those who excelled in the Talmud devoted their lives to the Talmud. Okay, now are there any questions? It seems by the fact when they moved their capital to Baghdad, and Baghdad became a cosmopolitan center, probably the Arabs felt that they should themselves be a instead of borrowing, in other words, the contributions of others and depending on others, they to produce their own, you know, their own doctors and their own scientists. In terms of astronomy, they had a, since one had to daven, one had to pray, we daven to Yerushalayim. So we daven easterly, you know, we're not really so careful, you know, as long as it's generally east. They wanted to be very careful, they're davening exactly to Mecca, to the Kaaba stone. So they wanted clearly, says, to have a complete knowledge of astronomy in terms of where things are, of geography and astronomy, and to know by the stars exactly, says, what directions are wherever you are, and that was an impetus. And there was a, because of the Persians evidently seem to have preserved to a greater degree the, you know, the, all of this culture. And they, many of the great Arabic scientists were really not Arabs by birth, and there's not descendants of those who came from the Arabian Peninsula, but were actually Persians, who, of course, who adopted Islam and the Arabic language. And it was part of their culture. They had the scientific curiosity. So everything together, you know, produces, and it had a tremendous impact upon Jews. One of the factors is really the it was they had great benefactors in the caliphs, you know, of the again, be this 100 years in 750 and 850 in terms of translating, and afterwards the next 100 years they were, you know, it's like studying in Kolo, you know, let's say you have to have some other form of thing, like a scientist, basically how science today is conducted by grants of the government or grants of foundations. On their own, those grants are not there, the science just withers. The Baghdad government started disintegrating towards the end of the 9th century, beginning of the 10th century. So really there was not much funding coming. So funding dried up. What happened was, though, that the Arabs in Spain, who at that time were very successful, took all of this over. And then that's why we have this tremendous, again, this growth of literature and science in the 11th, 12th century Spain. But eventually it all, you know, it's part of their history. But for the last, 800 years or so, really, there's not that much to speak about. Yeah. Yeah, it seems that Einstein had a very much, not in a mosaic sense, but he had a very much sense of religious experience, because all of this just could not come of its own. The fact is that every atom is exactly the same, and there are certain laws which govern everything, which seem to be valid in every, this is throughout, is indicative that there must be some controlling force that produced all of this. Okay. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, part, as far as I know, it really came from the Indians themselves. It's interesting, again, it's hard to know, but when the Greeks speak about the Jews, about as a nation of philosophers, they also speak in high regard of the Indians as philosophers. So, I don't have anything, but it would seem that the Indians themselves had at least there was an elite amongst them that had a highly developed culture. It's really hard. It's possible in terms of the knowledge of mathematics, building of mathematics, but it's really, a lot of it is really not very well substantiated. At the time, the Greeks really, Egypt was in decline. The day of their great building was thousands, or at least 1,000 years before. They were really not much to speak of, you know, in that period when the Greeks really expanded, you know, and took over Africa. So it's hard to say, really. Yeah. Right. Thank you. It's really hard. It's really hard to say. My guess is, even now the Rambam has it, by the time of the Talmud, the science that was used by and large in the Talmud was science which is prevalent in the time. It was not part of this original revelation. It was the science of the times, and medicine of the time.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.